There are plenty of major news stories you probably didn't hear or read about in the last year. With me now for today's Underreported is Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored and the co-editor of the latest edition of their annual report called Censored 2009, the top 25 censored stories of 2007-8. Also here is Jessica Lee, an editor and reporter with the Independent newspaper. She's written about the Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act here in the United States, one of those top 25 censored stories. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And Peter, when you call these stories censored, what do you mean? Are we talking about active censorship by the government, like banned books and stuff, or mainstream media outlets deciding that a story isn't right for them for one reason or another?
More the latter. And, the old Latin root censura, where government actually censored, in a modern world with full internet connections and access to stories from all over, there's a decision-making process that occurs inside corporate media and the big media institutions, and that's essentially that they're in the entertainment business, and they want to keep people listening and involved. And so very important news stories are often seen as not, don't have the value of keeping, as being entertaining, and go by the wayside.
Can it also be argued that there are simply too many problems going on around the world?
Of course. I mean, what we have to do is prioritize. That's exactly what Project Censored does. We look at thousands of news stories. We have over 200 researchers at Sonoma State University and then all over the country as well. And we evaluate whether the story's been covered by the corporate media in the U.S. and how important it is. And then it's vetted by a Ph.D. in the field, and we pick the top 25.
How many years have you been doing this?
I've been doing this 12. This is my 12th book. Project Censored's been at this for 32 years. Here at Sonoma State University. It was founded by Dr. Carl Jensen in 1976.
Is there anything unique about this year's edition?
It's a continuation of civil liberties loss and U.S. international efforts worldwide in terms of, like, global dominance, military global dominance. So the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, corruption, torture are all part of the agenda this year and have been for several years.
I guess that started in the year 2001. Did we see a major change after 9/11?
What we saw after 9/11 was more loss of civil liberties in particular. Last year, our number one story was about the suspension of habeas corpus for anybody, any person, a citizen or non, that the president designates as an enemy combatant or enemy of the state. That is an undermining of a principle that we've had in this in this country and in Western civilization for some 800 years now.
Jessica, you wrote about the Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act, or I guess its full name is the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. What's it all about?
Right. Well, actually, 1 year from today, on October 23rd, the U.S. House of Representatives passed this act. And the purpose of the act was to prevent so-called violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism in the United States.
Well, what does that mean?
Right.
Is it aimed at any kind of radical? I remember the Smith Act was passed with the support of the Communist Party because they thought it would be aimed at the Trotskyites, and then it wound up being used against the Communists. Is there a specific group that this act is aimed at?
Well, I appreciate the question because that was the main problem people across the country had with the act, and that was that it had very vague definitions. And if I could just go over a couple of those real quick. They defined violent radicalization as the process of adapting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. And homegrown terrorism was defined as the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individual to intimidate or coerce the United States government to further political or social objectives.
That's pretty broad.
It's very broad. It doesn't define extremist belief system, violence, force, or radical.
And how would the bill accomplish its goals?
Right. The bill wanted to establish two research bodies. One was a national commission, which would have 10 or 12 members, depending on the Senate or House version. And they were charged to examine and report upon the facts and causes of so-called violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence. And they would issue three reports over 18 months, 6 months apart, and they would give legislative recommendations on the prevention, disruption, and mitigation of these activities. The second thing that the Act wanted to establish was a Department of Homeland Security Center of Excellence.
And a Center of Excellence?
A Center of Excellence. I believe there's already eight of these around the country, but the Department of Homeland Security is creating these research centers at the university level to bring together a variety of disciplines to study a research topic. So in this case, it would be why people are becoming homegrown terrorists.
And this, my sense is, people could be prosecuted for simply having an extremist belief system. We're hoping that no prosecutor would go that far, but isn't that really part of this bill?
Well, that's the general fear that people had, and they organized against the Senate version, which slowly died earlier this year.
Well, who introduced it in the House? You say it passed in the House, so this means
right.
It had bipartisan support.
It did. Representative Jane Harman from California, she's a Democrat, wrote and introduced the bill. And what was interesting about the bill was that when it was brought up for vote, they enacted what's called the suspension of the rules, which is a provision used to quickly pass non-controversial bills, such as funding bills, that kind of thing. And in this case, they enacted suspension of the rules, which means that debate is limited to 40 minutes, and it needs two-thirds majority to pass. And it did pass 404-6 at the time.
Six opposed it?
That's right.
Have either Senators Obama or McCain made their opinions about this bill known?
I did approach Senator Obama last December about the bill because he sits on the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. So he would be voting to bring the Senate bill to the Senate for a vote. And initially, he seemed for the bill, but then his office issued a clarification, which was that if the bill came up to vote, that he would evaluate it like he does all pieces of legislation. I haven't heard anything from Senator McCain. Representative Ron Paul, who was running for president in the primaries, was against the bill, although when the bill came up for vote in the House, he wasn't present for the vote.
Why do you think this didn't get more newspaper coverage? This is a pretty extensive bill. This would really have a major impact on civil liberties in this country if it had passed.
That's true. I think it follows the trend of the mainstream media being very disinterested in topics of civil liberties and civil rights, in particular when it affects groups who dissent with the current administration. Since 9/11, we've seen a slow eroding of rights of people, especially people engaged in nonviolent protests.
But as attitudes have changed about the war in Iraq and Guantanamo, in fact, everything after Abu Ghraib, I would have thought that this would have been the kind of thing newspapers would have grabbed onto.
I would have hoped so. What I found was interesting was when I first heard about the bill, there was really only one story out there. It was the story written by In These Times out of Chicago. And then for the most part, it was just individuals using the internet through YouTube and through blogs who were expressing outrage about the bill. And there was no mainstream media coverage. And then when my article came out, it was picked up by the alternative media and spread again through this internet network of people and blogs. But again, the mainstream media was just very disinterested.
You have an interesting story about how Joe Lieberman has gotten involved in this.
That's true. From what I've heard from my sources, the Senate expected the bill to quickly pass, but constituents from all over the country called and gave him trouble, and so the bill kind of was put on the back burner. But that didn't stop Senator Lieberman and Susan Collins, who's a Republican from Maine, who chair this committee, to kind of keep going anyways. And on May 8th, they issued their own report, just by them, which is called The Violent Islamic Extremism, the Internet.
Oh, they got more specific. They said Islamic extremists.
Right. But then, just 11 days later, on May 19th, Senator Lieberman sent a letter to Google requesting that they remove all videos produced by groups listed on the U.S. terrorism list. And Google evaluated each video specifically and agreed on May 19th that they would take down 80 videos because they violated their community guidelines, which are they're not going to post any videos that have gratuitous violence, advocating violence, or using hate speech. But Google refused to censor all videos, which Lieberman wanted him to do. And again, Lieberman's kind of been going at it. And on September 11th of this year, Google finally slightly revised their community guidelines for posting videos. But sort of the latest news on this was that on October 20th, the RAND Corporation, who had testified for this other act, the Homegrown Terrorism Act, had sent their director of their Center for Global Risk and Security, Gregory Treverton, to a House hearing to discuss the pros and cons of creating a domestic counterterrorism service. And the Department of Homeland Security had requested the RAND Corporation to do the study. So again, while this bill seems to be dead, members of Congress are still moving towards these original objectives, which is to go and study these people who have these, quote, violent ideologies.
My guests on Underreported today are Jessica Lee, an editor and reporter with the Independent newspaper, also Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored, co-editor of the latest edition of their annual report called Censored 2009, the top 25 censored stories of 2007-8, published by Seven Stories Press. Peter, had you heard of this story before you started putting the book together?
Actually, yes. About a year ago, we saw it on the internet that it had passed, and became interested in it, and then had students research who had written about it and followed up on it. So that's how it ended up in the book this year.
What about go ahead.
One of our political scientists on campus looked at it and said, "Oh, wow, this is concerning." ACLU was very concerned. So it had a red flag, and it made it through the whole process of our voting and was selected in the top 10.
What are some of the other top stories?
Well, the number one story is about the surveys that have been done in Iraq on civilian casualties. And we've had three major surveys. Two were done by Johns Hopkins University in 2003-2006. The last one said that there was close to 600,000 civilian casualties. The most recent one was done by Opinion Research Business, which is a group out of Great Britain. And they surveyed 2,400 families in 15 of the 18 Iraqi provinces and found that that one out of five, literally, had had someone die violently since the U.S. invasion related directly to the war. That is over 900,000 people.
So that's more than died in Rwanda.
It's the same number that died in Rwanda. So we really have approached levels of genocide among civilians in Iraq since the U.S. invasion. Now, the John Hopkins study showed that half of those people that had died at that point had died by U.S. aerial bombing. So these are people in their homes where a bomb falls and kills them or the family. And this goes unreported. You know, embedded reporters with the U.S. troops and the U.S. News Service, they're not out there in the villages. And so these are three reliable national surveys that now show that we're in excess of a million civilian casualties. On the top of that, there's millions more that have been wounded, and over 5 million that have been displaced from their homes or living internally in Iraq or in other countries.
How many media outlets picked up on this story?
None. This got zero coverage. This was on Interpress, so it was available. That's a wire service. It was on Alternet twice, and it was on the weblog after Downing Street. So it was available quite openly on the internet and from various news sources, but the corporate media just ignored it.
Another of your top censored stories was H-2 visas. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, H-2 visas are guest workers who come to the United States under a special work program, and they're literally locked into the job and the employer that they have. And they become victims of bait and switch schemes. In other words, they're paying money to come here. They're recruited through labor contractors in their countries. This could be Bangladesh, India, Malaysia. They pay money, and then sometimes even mortgaging their whole house, and then they'll come to the United States. They'll work for literally minimum wage. Sometimes live in dormitories. Southern Poverty Law Center reports that there's 150,000 guest workers now in the U.S. And that these recruitment fees can be tens of millions of dollars. And this is a program where people can actually be fully exploited. Their bosses can hold their documents. They can work them overtime, and they have no legal justification. They have no unions, no rights whatsoever, no medical benefits, and no access to legal service. In other words, they're like, it's very similar to slavery. As Charles Rangel called it, the closest thing he'd ever seen to slavery in the United States.
They also got no media coverage.
They got no media coverage. That's true. We saw this story. It was in Southern Poverty Law Center wrote about it, and The Nation magazine wrote about it, and it was also written about over in India, in Times of India.
What about election-related censored stories over the past year? Have there been any?
Well, certainly one of our biggest stories on election issues was the 2004 election. And Steve Freeman from the University of Pennsylvania, statistician there, has now written a book, Was the 2004 Election Stolen? And he was quite clear that the exit polls showed that Kerry won by 6 million votes and that Bush won, of course, officially by 3 million votes. And that's a 9 million vote discrepancy from the election polls. That's an impossible number, particularly because it happened primarily in 13 states. Most of the states, the exit polls match the actual results. So exit polls are quite accurate polling process. When you poll 11,000 people, asking them when they've walked out of a polling booth who they voted for 5 minutes ago, it's not likely they forgot. And so you're in the 99.5 percentile of accuracy. Often they're used to call elections all over the world, but here in the U.S., we got no coverage of that, and then any concern about that there was fraud in the 2004 election has just completely been ignored by the corporate media.
Well, have things improved in a way because there are citizen journalists and bloggers who are putting these stories on the internet, or do you think that they've gotten worse because traditional media outlets, newspapers, radio, and TV are struggling, which means that they're more likely to only cover stories that they think will attract a wider audience?
Well, certainly Mark Crispin Miller has written a book about election fraud. Robert Kennedy Jr., Greg Palast, all of these people have been addressing these issues and talking about voter fraud in the United States. Now, if voting machines can be hacked, which has been clearly demonstrated by black box voting in a number of universities, have had, you know, really junior-level hackers be able to get into these machines. Some have been corrected. Secretary of State Bowen here in California has limited access to the Diebel machines and tried to make sure they're protected. But what we're talking about is private proprietary software systems inside voting machines that the U.S. public cannot have access to. And we're basically the only country in the world that allows that. So hacking a small group of people on the outside, going in and changing votes is still possible.
Now, when you publish this book, do you see anything reflected in the way the mainstream media react? Are they waiting for this book to come out so that they can find their next big story? Do they apologize for dropping the ball on something they should have covered?
When the censored stories come out each year, we get very little corporate media coverage. It's in the alternative weeklies. It's in the independent press all over the country. Our website gets millions of hits. Millions of people are seeing these stories, often for the first time. About a third of them have gone on to receive national media coverage. But rarely does it happen that we bring a story out and it's immediately picked up by the New York Times or some other major media outlet.
Peter Phillips, along with Andrew Roth and Project Censored, has put together Censored 2009. It's published by Seven Stories Press. Thank you so much for being with us. And Jennifer Lee, an editor and reporter for the Independent newspaper, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Lenny.